Okay. Always remember, when you get to Nirvana, all your questions are answered. So no one's got to Nirvana yet. Never mind. We can start early today, 8 o'clock. Start for today's Q&A. And here we go, the first one today. Anirban, why don't you set up a meditation center or a nunnery in Malaysia? Give it a thought, please. Oh. You have no compassion on this poor monk. Okay, you set it up, I'll teach. Give it a thought, please. Okay, only says give it a thought, not give it many thoughts. So I've given it a thought. Nothing good about it. And can a nun disrobe? Yeah, a nun can disrobe, just like novices disrobe. But there's no ceremony for a nun disrobing. In other words, when they really say to themselves, I'm no longer a nun, then they're no longer a nun. So they just have a clear resolution inside their mind, and that's enough. Same with a novice, a clear resolution in their mind, from this time on I'm no longer a novice, then it's disrobing. It's actually very easy. It's actually to disrobe as a monk, as a nun. It's very hard to ordain, but it's very easy to leave. And usually the fact is that most people, monks, nuns, they value the lifestyle and the opportunity, the privilege to walk in the footsteps of the Buddha so much that it's very sort of hard to disrobe, sort of emotionally. But physically, it's very easy. Okay. Next question, does rebirth take place immediately when one dies? If yes, why do we have to share merits with the departed ones? And does it mean that we don't have to pray to the dead? Please explain. Okay, it's an old controversy, which is really no controversy at all. In that intermediate realm, they call the Antarabhava realm, where you can see your loved ones as ghosts, or hear them, or feel them. Sometimes you hear their speech. But, actually, I told this story in, not just human beings, even animals have an intermediate realm. This story was told to me recently in Perth. There was a lady, I told this in Singapore just before I left. Lady disciple, she lived alone, she didn't have a husband, I think her children were all grown up, and her best friend was her dog. She had this little dog who she looked upon as being like her child. And they were so close together. You may understand that the human being's emotional connection with the animals is sometimes so strong. And this was one of those very strong attachments. They were very close together, this middle-aged woman and her dog. She used to take the dog walking every morning in a patch of forest not far from her home. And one day she was walking in the forest, and she lost one of her very precious finger rings. And together with the dog, they were looking here, looking there for it in the forest. Because it's a forest, once you lose something in the forest, it's so hard to find. So they spent a long time looking for it, but she could not find it. So she gave it up for lost. It was very sad, but she gave it up for lost. But of course, she forgot about it a few days later when her dog died. And she was so upset the dog died, so she did a little funeral service for the dog. But she swears that for the next few days, she heard that dog barking in her house. The ghost dog. And if you've been with an animal like that for many years, you know the sound of your dog's bark. And it's very different from other dogs. You can recognize it in the same way that when you live with a person, you recognize the tone of their voice. So it was a ghost dog in her house for many, many days, always barking in a nice way. But what really convinced her that that was her dog in that Antarabhava realm was that one morning she heard her dog barking right outside her front door, very, very clear. So she opened the door. Of course, there was no dog there, but right on her front mat was her lost ring. The dog had found her finger ring. Isn't that a nice story? A true story. Those are strange stories, you just can't make them up because, you know, they're just, reality is just beyond invention. So there is such a realm even for dogs as well, but the point is that is that a pause between rebirth? Or can we say, and this is what I say, it is a type of rebirth. You get reborn into that Antarabhava realm for just a short while before you go off somewhere else. So it's really not an argument at all. It's really, you know, what you call rebirth, that's all. So you're reborn into that little realm for a short while, making sure everything is sorted out. If you're a dog, to make sure you find your owner's finger ring. If you're a human being, to make sure the funeral's done all well, everyone's happy and well, and then you go off into the next life. So it's no real argument at all. So it is good to still pray for the dead and make merits for the dead, and you can even make merits for your dead dog or cat or whatever. You can do a little ceremony and ask to share the merits, not with all your relations, but even the animals if you shared your life with. Isn't that nice? Next question, Ajahn Brahm. Why, when I do metta meditation, I just feel like crying, and soon I cry. Is it normal to feel sad at first? Many thanks. There are tears of sadness, there are tears of joy. A lot of the times is when we do metta meditation, we're getting our emotional world strong. I mentioned already that the jhanas are emotional states, they're not intellectual states. You can't think your way into jhana. You have to feel your way into jhana. And say with metta, loving kindness. You may say, may all beings be happy and well, may all beings be free from suffering. If it's only words, you don't feel it, it's not real. But when it really becomes a reality, a strong loving kindness, you get so much happiness, so much energy, you get emotionally powerful. And sometimes when you do get emotionally powerful, that's what happens. When strong emotions, we tend to cry. And it's not just girls, it's boys as well, because it comes from the mind. Even animals as well cry. I've seen animals cry. Have you seen animals cry? Even animals, when they get those strong emotions, they too will cry. So, if you have that loving kindness and the tears start coming down, cry. In the morning when we do this, no one can see your face except me. They can only see your back. And it's dark anyway, so you can cry as much as you like. Only I will see it. But I don't mind. So it's quite normal to cry. And it's not only just when you get into metta meditation. If you get into nimittas sometimes, it's so strong the tears flow down. Or if you do listen to a very good Dharma discourse, a Dharma teaching, or sometimes it's just so sweet, you get so inspired, just cry. I told this to a few people on the retreats, on the interviews. It has happened a few times when I have been giving a Dharma discourse, a Dharma teaching. It's usually only in my monastery when I really get into deep Dharma. And as I'm talking, I cry. And I start listening to some of the words which come out of my mouth and I think, my goodness, where did that come from? And it's just so profound. And I'm listening to me as I talk. And it's profound and I start crying in my own Dharma discourses. I've done that a few times. Can't help it. It's lovely. And other times, if you go like to places like in India, to where the Buddha lived, ooh, those are powerful places. There's one place, up in the Vulture's Peak, I always cry up there. Because I don't know why, but it's so powerful. The Buddha lived up there. No doubt that you can sit there in the caves where the Buddha sat meditation. If that doesn't sort of get you going, I don't know what will. So that's one of the places where you can get really high. It's one of the expressions of piti, of joy. Joy in the Dhamma, joy in the fact that you're being born in a time when the Buddha Dhamma and the Sangha is still so alive. It's joy at listening to the Dhamma, the most wonderful thing you can ever hear. It's joy at realizing the Dhamma, like some metta, the joy of getting close to the jhanas. Oh, these are incredibly powerful states. Of course you will cry. And it's wonderful. Next question. Dear Ajahn, 5 days before I came on this retreat, I had a dream that I passed away. Now I'm very scared of thinking of it. Does this dream actually mean anything? Aha. It really scared the daylights out of me. Please share your thoughts on this matter. Thank you. Okay, when you have dreams like that, sometimes the dream is one thing, but your interpretation of it is different. Sometimes we get it wrong.
In other words, there's some truth there, but we misinterpret it. So in this particular case, you dreamt that you were passing away. Your ego, yourself, your delusions, those are the ones about to pass away. Not your body, not your life, but your delusions. Isn't that a wonderful dream? The ego, the I, is about to die. Isn't that wonderful? Have any of you been doing that meditation? I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Nah, you're too scared. Try it, give it a try. It's wonderful. Ajahn Chah always used to say, one of his favorite sayings when I was a young monk, have you come here to die? Have you ordained to die? And of course, now what do you mean by that? What he meant by your ego, yourself, your self-centeredness. You allow that to die. So that must have been a great prophetic dream. You don't have to be scared. You have to be excited and wondered, oh, what a wonderful thing it is. I'm about to disappear. And all that's left when you're gone is the Dhamma. Ooh, that's nice. Dear Venerable Sir, why are dancing, singing and music in the eight precepts? Why can't we do these things? I really don't understand. Please tell me why. Okay, if whoever wrote this question, if you heard her singing, you'd understand why. Because we don't want to inflict suffering on others. No, you've probably got a good voice. So, dancing, singing, and music. The point is that when we're singing, sometimes we sing incredible silly things, like rap music, my baby's left me, blah, blah, blah. I don't know the last time I listened to music, but if you actually listen to what it says, it's absolutely ridiculous and stupid. It's the same. I was on an aircraft some years ago, and the in-flight movie was, I think it was called Armageddon. Now, of course, I didn't have any of the headphones, so I just watched it without headphones. Try that. It's really good fun, because then it looks so stupid. When you haven't got all the music and the dialogue, it's just so predictable. I remember this one scene, I was just watching it up there and laughing my head off. I think one scene, in some sort of spacecraft or other, and it went over the cliffs and it went smash, bang, explosions all over the place. And no, that would have killed anybody 10 times over. But I knew that they couldn't die because it was a hero, you know, the main film star. And so after the last explosion, you know, like 10 minutes of pyrotechnics, the last explosion, everything went quiet. There's no explosions. And then you just saw a hand come up at the edge of the screen. I thought, oh, come on. And then the hero came up. He didn't even have a sort of a soot mark on his face. All his hair was just perfect, as if he'd just been to the coiffeur. He didn't even have a bead of sweat on him. And I thought, oh, come on. But it's so funny. So actually, when actually you stand back and look at these things, it's completely ridiculous, these movies. So because of that, and even dancing as well. If you're in the lay world, fine, you can go dancing, especially you're young, you've got to meet your partner in life, that's usually when you do it. And remember, you always dance when it's dark. If it was light, you'd never fall in love. And that's why afterwards you come and complain to me about your husband, about your wife. Look, you got yourself into that. You know, you weren't mindful. So next time if you really want to sort of choose a partner, just go out in the middle of the day, you know, with all your glasses on and just really look at them. See them. But as we go dancing in the dark so we can fall in love, because that's what we love to do. We're all romantic. And the same with singing. If you listen to the words of the song, they're really ridiculous. And like, write the words down and think, what a stupid thing that is, what you say. And like music, even like music. Sometimes it can make us sad, it can make us happy, it can play with our emotions. We want to get some mindfulness. Sometimes we listen to music, we get completely absorbed into the music, and we forget what we're really doing. Sometimes you listen to music while you're driving your car, and you're going, you know, bang, bang, bang with the rap music, and then before you know it, it's not bang, bang, the rap music, it's bang, 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 as you hit another car. You lose your mindfulness. So be careful with me. And if we're 8 precepts, we have the most amazing music of all, the music of silence. That's just so nice. We have the most amazing sort of singing of all, the singing of loving kindness. That's nice. And the most amazing movie of all time, the blockbuster Nimitta. So we do have singing, dancing music, but Buddhist music. Okay. Can you please tell us something about crystals and aura? Has crystals any effect on meditation? Okay. I don't know. I've never really messed around with crystals and auras and stuff like that. But if it works for you, then do it. I do know, though, that some places are just really easy to meditate. They've got power centers. I don't think it's, well, maybe a crystal might sort of help that, but you can make your own power center. Because there's places where I've meditated. This place here is getting much stronger now since we began, because we have so many people meditating, so much good energy, so much good vibes going, that the place gets easier to meditate in. And I've known that because when we started our monastery in Australia, it was a dead area. But as you're meditating more and more, and you get great monks coming into that monastery, and really good meditations happening there, that place is getting really powerful now. My monastery in Serpentine. And I think I mentioned to some people that some years ago an Aboriginal tried to get in there and he couldn't come in. He said, it's too powerful for me. And many people, they go in that gate and they realize they've gone into a different area. Just the opposite side of that gate, it's ordinary. Inside, you've got energy. You can feel it. And when you go into my main hall, that's really strong. But one of the strongest places, many of you know that I went on a retreat for 6 months. I never spoke to anybody, never saw anybody for 6 months, just meditating in one of the huts in my monastery in Australia. Complete seclusion. Really bliss. 6 months of no visual contact with a person, no audio contact with a person. But I found out afterwards that the monks, my disciples, they were just wheeling and dealing, trying to be the next person to sit in that hut. Because I had to move back into my hut, and that was a vacant hut. And they wanted to go in there to get off on the energy. And the monk who actually managed to get chosen to take over that after I left, he said he went there just after I left. He couldn't go in. It was just too strong, too much for him. The energy in that room was all really strong. And, you know, people could feel that. So you can build up energy in these places. And you can feel it. Ooh, I don't think my mind's up to this. So that's what you can do. You do get sort of meditation energy. And, of course, the aura. That's how the mind will see sort of the energy around a person. With, you know, not seeing it with the eye, but seeing it with the mind. When your mind gets strong, it's amazing the sort of stuff you can see. Any questions on that one? Next question. During the Buddhist period, lay people such as Anathapindika and Household Dacitta have obtained Sotapanna and Anagami. Are there any lay people Bhante know that have attained the stage of Sotapanna, and out of compassion for us, please show us how, despite the daily activities? Okay, there is probably some people who are stream winners, but it's hard to do. You need a lot of faith, a lot of wisdom. No messing around. So you can do that, but you have to be really committed to the Dhamma. Not messing around. And you have to be a good meditator as well, a deep meditator. So it was possible in the time of the Buddha. Of course it's possible now. And sometimes people think that the people around in the time of the Buddha were somehow different than people today. But they're not exactly the same. And where you can find that out is part of the Tipitaka. It's called the Vinaya Pitaka. It's not just the rules for monks and nuns. There's some Dhamma in there as well. And not only that, they give like accounts of life in the time of the Buddha. You know, about what happened. And especially when monks or nuns made mistakes. And because they made a mistake, you have to lay down a rule as a consequence. And so you have all of these little stories, not just of the great monks, not just of the great monks and the great nuns doing these amazing feats of meditation, but of the ordinary monks who made mistakes, of the nuns who did stupid things. And one of my favorite stories from that collection is of this nun who was cleaning up one morning in her monastery. This was actually in Sawati. And she had the bucket of night soil. Now, the feces from the night before. And instead of putting it in the correct place, she decided to throw it over the wall. Over the monastery wall of a compound. And it just so happened that on the opposite side of the wall, there was a man who was on his way to the palace in his best clothes, perfectly groomed, when his bucket of shit fell on his head. And quite understandably, he wasn't happy. In fact, he was furious. In fact, he was incensed. And he got one of his flaming torches, and he said, these prostitutes dressed up as nuns, these shameless women, I'm going to burn down their monastery. How can you do this to me? And you'd be rightly quite crazy and mad, you know, if you get a bucket of that stuff on your head when you're just going out to see the king. So he went in there determined to burn down the monastery, but they had a temple attendant. And the temple attendant was very smart. He said, where are you going? I'm going to burn down all the huts and the buildings of these shameless nuns. Look what they did to me! And the attendant said, they poured that on your head? Yes! Oh my goodness, he said. That's auspicious. That's really lucky. That's even better than holy water. And the man said, really? These are holy nuns in this monastery. If they poured that and you had the good fortune to be standing underneath it when it came, you can't get luckier than that. Oh, that's incredible good fortune. Oh, I didn't realize that. Oh, sadhu, thank you. Now that was really quick thinking on the part of that attendant. So according to the story, the attendant said, now listen, that's such good fortune. Go home quickly. So get washed and changed again into some new clothes. Go to the king's palace. Something very lucky is going to happen to you. Oh, really? So just like, you know, people in Malaysia are into good luck. So was he in the time of the Buddha. And they believe anything sometimes. And so he did he. And then he went there and he went to the palace. And then he got this amazing contract which made him a fortune from the king. But when the Buddha heard that story, called all the nuns together and said, listen, you got away with it this time, thanks to that very, very smart attendant. But now we'll make a rule. You should not throw the bucket of over the monastery wall. And that was the story. You can read that in the Bhikkhuni Patimokkha. So, people haven't changed in all these years. They're just exactly the same. We do silly, stupid things. And sometimes we can be very smart. We can be gullible. We can actually believe in luck. Just as in the time of the Buddha. So people haven't changed. So if they could become enlightened in those days, they can become enlightened now. Look, extreme winners in those days, extreme winners today. So yeah, you can do those things. Yeah? Can you enter the stream without practicing samadhi? And that's a very good question. It's one of those open questions. Personally, I say you do need jhanas. Because I can't see any other way of doing it. That might be the limit of my experience and wisdom, but there's many monks who support that. They say, yeah, you do need jhanas to become a stream winner. Other people say, no, it's possible. And there is some evidence for that in the time of the Buddha. It was possible without the jhanas. But certainly it helps. So that's an open question. I can't really say for sure. Give it a try. But if you get the deep meditations, it is, everyone agrees on this, much, much easier. I gave a simile some time ago. It's like, for example, you know, we're here in KL. If you want to get to Penang, it's possible to walk there, but it's very, very difficult. So, it's much better to get on a car, a bus, or an aeroplane. It's much easier to get there. So because those vehicles are available, you should get on those vehicles. In the same way, it might be possible to get to stream winning without meditation. But because you've got this wonderful vehicle of meditation, you might as well get on it and take the easy way. So it might be possible by not having meditation, but I can't really see it. Just the same way, it might be possible to walk from PJ to Penang, but has anyone here done that? So it's a bit too difficult. Aha. You're talking about sometimes people gain stages of enlightenment in the time of the Buddha just by listening to Dhamma. It wasn't just by listening to Dhamma they gained enlightenment, because that doesn't really pay much attention to all the things they were doing before. This is like, for example, you may go into like a university convocation center. You might just walk in there one afternoon and see somebody getting their degree. And you see them dressed up in a gown and a funny hat. And all they do is just to wait and sit down until their name is called out. And they go up to see this dignitary and they receive this little diploma. If that's all you see, you think, oh, all you need to do to get a degree is actually sit in this hall at the right time and then get your name called up and then you just, you know, get your degree. It's like a photograph of the last event which led up to you getting your degree. It doesn't take into account all of the hard work, the lectures, the assignments, the research, the exams you did before that time when you received the degree. In fact, when you go to people's homes, that's all you see. You see a photograph of them receiving their degree. You never see photographs of them going to lectures or doing their exams or sitting in front of the computer doing their assignment. You only take the photograph of the last moment. In the same way, in the suttas, very often, you just have the photograph, the story of the last little event which actually created the enlightenment. Even though all those other events, the other hard work, all the teachings they listened to, all of the meditation they did, all of the aches and pains which they had in their body when they were sitting meditation just like you, all the despair they got when sometimes they thought they were getting nowhere. You don't see that in the suttas. Or sometimes you do. But mostly you see that final event, that last little piece in the jigsaw puzzle when someone became enlightened. But the full story is much bigger than that. That makes sense? Yes, well, you can read the suttas. We certainly agree with that. It's hard, it's impossible, actually, to say that you can get to Anagami or Arahat without jhanas. There are other places where it seems to say that, yes, you do need jhanas to get stream winning. In the Anguttara Nikaya, there's a passage which says that. But there's other passages which seem to be opposite. So this... It's a case not proven on either side. From the suttas, it seems you need. Sometimes you need it, sometimes you don't. So it's ambiguous. So I can quote the suttas too, which says, yeah, it looks like you do need it. But without, actually, what the sutta is without grasping the nimitta of samadhi, in other words, without gaining the jhana, you can't obtain samadhiti, right view. Now that's one saying in there, in the suttas. It's in the Anguttara Nikaya, and that's one I quote, actually, to give weight to the idea you do need the jhanas to gain even stream winning. But I will talk about that tonight, because this evening when I talk about seeing things as they truly are, I'm going to especially focus on why the experience of jhanas gives rise to enlightening insight. Because from experience as well as from the suttas, I will explain why it's so vital. So we're not just going on theory, who said what, but I'm going on to explain why this is so. And hopefully you'll be able to understand it from the explanation I give. Okay, next question. When I was having my meditative meal, as I closed my eyes, bright nimitta still appears, so I stop biting and contemplate for a while. Is it true that eating could also bring about insight? Yep, sure. When you're eating your food, you can contemplate impermanence. In fact, it's very impermanent on my plate. It doesn't last that long at all. Sometimes it's suffering, because if it's very delicious food, again, it soon finishes, and oh, my delicious tastes are all gone. And if it's not delicious food, why do I have to eat this? Especially as a monk, because people are always standing over you, say, eat this, this is really nice, eat this, eat this. So sometimes you have to put in your mouth things you would rather not put in your mouth. So, eating can be meditation. It's anatta. It's not mine. You can't keep anything. If you can't be attached to the food, as long as it's in the mouth, it will soon come out later. And whenever you're eating, always reflect on this. You know when you go to the toilet, when the feces come out, they're all brown and smelly. Where do those feces come from? They must be in the food there somewhere. They're actually, you know, covered up, almost like packaged. So actually, because what that food is feces plus a few proteins and vitamins. And it goes in the body, the proteins and vitamins get taken out, and what was left, which was there in the beginning, comes out the other end. And so when you're taking your lunch, in that rice, those noodles, there's feces under there somewhere. They can't come from nowhere. That'll stop you eating a lot. That's meditation. Dear Ajahn, does a talisman blessed by a monk work? If so, in what ways is it useful? Does it have a shelf life? Yeah. No, these talismans blessed by a monk. There was my great teacher Ajahn Chah. He would never give out those talismans. Never. Except once. Because this young man came to see him and he was about to join the Thai army. He'd been conscripted. And he didn't have a choice. He had to go. And even in those days there were many skirmishes on the borders between Laos, Burma and Cambodia. Even though they're supposed to be friendly, the armies still every now and again shot at each other. Many people have been killed. It wasn't reported in the papers, but it was still happening. And he was very scared. So he asked Ajahn Chah, he'd been a disciple for many years, his family had been disciples, Ajahn Chah, please give me one of these little Buddha medallions I can put around my neck to protect me from bullets. And Ajahn said, no, look, we don't do that. He said, please, look, I've been giving you all this dana. You're supposed to be compassionate. You teach us about gratitude. Our parents helped us. We should help our parents. I've been helping you. Now you help me. And so Ajahn Chah gave him. He said, okay, I'm going to give you a Buddha to hang around your neck. And I guarantee it will protect you from bullets. And he was so excited. Because Ajahn Chah very rarely gives this. And a Buddha to protect him from bullets when he's in the army. He was so happy. Okay, can I have it, he said. Go in the main hall, that big 6-foot Buddha over there. That's what I'm giving you, to wear around your neck. And it will protect you from bullets. That's the only one which works. He was just such a fun monk to be around. And it's true. That's the only one which protects you. I read in the newspapers in Australia, there was a general who had one of these very expensive talismans and medallions. You can buy them in Bangkok, and some of these things cost $500,000. Incredible. That's years ago, they've probably gone up to $1 million now or more or something. Some of these medallions are so rare and so expensive, that's how much they cost. And the reason they cost that much, they're reputed to protect you from everything. So being a general in the Thai army with lots of power, and because of corruption, he was very wealthy. He had one of these medallions. And the story was, he was in the officers' mess somewhere in Bangkok, a general with one of his officers, a major. They'd both been drinking, and as a boast, the general pointed out this medallion. $500,000 US, protect you against anything. Yeah? Yeah. So the general said, here, I'll show you. Here's my gun, shoot me. And it was an order. The general ordered the major to take the gun and shoot him. So the major had no choice. Maybe because they were a bit drunk anyway that he did it. And he pulled the gun up at the general and shot, pulled the trigger. And the bullet came out and killed the general. What a stupid general. That's why I was in the Australian papers. There was a general who died in the officer's mess, was shot by the major because he was testing out the talismans. So don't be stupid. If you want to be protected, the best talisman which actually works and has got an eternal shelf life is the 5 precepts. So wear those around your neck and they will protect you from so much harm. So that's the talismans which good monks give out. Not little Buddhas. The little Buddha there is actually to remind you of your religion. So you can carry that around. There's nothing wrong with having a talisman like that, a little Buddha. But you look at that and remember that you're a disciple of the Buddha. Remember what the Buddha means about peace, virtue, compassion, wisdom. And use that as like a little shrine you carry around your neck to remind you of the great teacher. And that will have an eternal shelf life. Next question. Dear Ajahn, I have heard about Thai forest monks who go into such deep meditation that they are able to levitate above ground. I'm curious on the subject and wonder why it occurs. Speaking of super monks, for your information, there was already a Hollywood movie called The Bulletproof Monk, starring Chow Yun-Fat, where apparently he is a monk who can levitate, jump really impossible heights, and is bulletproof. Incidentally, the movie was based on Tibetan tradition with metta. Okay, but was he violent? Was there any sex involved? Was there any sex involved? Not violent at all. Oh, very good. There was violence, yeah. If it was really the Buddhist tradition, there'd be no violence. There'd be people about to fight each other, and the bulletproof monk or the super monk would come up and say, hatred never ceases from hatred. It only ceases through love. Now, that'd be really, really inspiring, but unfortunately people like violence. That's why they go to the movies, to see violence. I remember as a student in the university film club, there's a very, very brilliant young man who was the president of the university film club that year. And they had all these films they were going to show, you know, the real films. And he put forth the program for the next term about what the films were. And he named the film and then gave a brief description of their content. And it was like, you know, Zulu, the content, sex and violence in South Africa. They had another film, sort of, Madigan or something, sex and violence in Los Angeles. And everything was just sex and violence, just in different locations. And you couldn't fault him in his description, because that's all that movies are. Sex and violence in China, sex and violence in Hollywood, sex and violence sort of all over the world, sex and violence, you know, in the Twin Towers, that's James Bond. Because that's what people want from their movies. So, Super Monk would not have any sex and violence. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Probably wouldn't sell, but it'd be wonderful. But levitation. Can monks levitate? Yes, some monks can levitate. How do you think I got here to Malaysia? I levitated in Singapore Airlines. Flying through the air at 30,000 feet. No. But some people can do this naturally. But if any monk does have any psychic power, any nun, they never show it. Imagine what it would be like if someone saw me levitate. The Australian government would come up to me and say, Ajahn Brahm, you have to go to Beijing for the Olympics. We need that gold medal for the high jump. If you could do this, the Malaysian government, does it give like $1 million or something if you win a gold medal at the Olympics? Maybe you can learn levitation if you win a gold medal at the Olympics. Maybe you can learn levitation. And you can give $1 million, we'll split it 50-50 from Chimpaka Buddhist Lodge and my new retreat centre. Imagine if you could read minds. If you could really read somebody's minds at will. Imagine the Malaysian, let alone the Malaysian Secret Service, CIA, will get you to go to Abu Ghraib jail or Guantanamo Bay. They wouldn't need any trials or interrogation. They'd just say, this Arab over here, is he a terrorist? This person over here. They'd be stationing you at the doors of the airport, just checking people as they go in. It'd be much more effective than X-rays and these other security systems. You spend all your time at the airport terminals checking to see whether any terrorists are going on the plane. Well, it would be terrible if people found out you could read people's minds. Not only that, if I could read your mind and you knew it, you'd run out of this room straight away. You'd be so scared. No, so if you do have those psychic powers, we keep it secret. And it's also, if you do gain the ability to read people's minds, you just don't do it because it's an invasion of privacy. It's just like reading somebody's mail. You will not do it unless you have their permission. So, be sort of content that any good monk will not read your mind unless you ask them to. So, this is about sort of this. They can levitate, they can do all these amazing things, but don't usually show it. It just gets him into trouble. But imagine, I always watch the breath, and then sleepiness overcame and I fell asleep. After a while, I woke up and it goes in a circle again. Venerable advised not to control sleepiness. Thus does a mind become lazy as it wants to sleep all the time. No, all the sleepiness will just go by itself. After a while, you lose all your sleep deficit. I say this because as lay people, you just work so hard. You run around, you've got so many things to do. At the very least, you get rid of the stress of trying. And you actually live a long life that way. Because sometimes what happens is that we're so stressed, we force ourselves so hard. When you're at work, you're struggling. Even when you're at play, you're struggling. When you come to a retreat, you struggle. When you go home, you always struggle. And after a while, you can't live like that very long. That's where you get all these sicknesses from, all these cancers, stress disorders, heart problems and stuff like that. You don't need to be sort of a medical scientist to know where all these sicknesses come from. So just to relax and don't judge yourself so much. Don't try so hard. Don't have any expectations. If all you do in this retreat is sleep, 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 I'll say sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. You're letting go. You're getting more peaceful. When meditation happens, it just happens. When it's ready, it will come and visit you. So you just need to make your mind peaceful, kind, and open, and meditation comes to you. One of the women I really respect, she was a meditator. She came to my first retreat in Sydney. She was an executive in some big firm in Sydney. She spent the first 3 days sleeping. She would get up at 7 o'clock, just before breakfast. She wouldn't come to any morning sittings or chanting. She'd get out of bed, have the breakfast, then go back to her room and go back to sleep. Get up again for lunch, have a nap in the afternoon, maybe sit for an hour or two in the afternoon, and then have an early night in the evening. I really respected her. She told me because she was in a dormitory, see, all the other girls in that dormitory room were just looking at her with utter contempt, with anger. Actually, I said, it's not contempt or anger, it's jealousy. They wish they had the guts and the courage to do what you're doing. They see someone sleeping there, say, why don't I go? Oh, I can't go to sleep, I've got to put forth effort. Have a sleep, for goodness sake. So for the first 3 days, she slept most of the time. After 3 days, her sleep deficit disappeared. She felt good. She got up naturally. She wanted to get up. And she came and sat. She wasn't sleepy in the morning sits like everybody else was because she had rested. She soon caught up with other people in her progress of meditation. By the end of the retreat, she was one of the star meditators. And I always take up her example to teach other people about how to meditate. Go at your own pace. Don't look at other people. If you're tired, sleep. The sooner you get that rest out of the way, the sooner you feel free and able to really have some good meditation. I know that from my own experience, I was told only to sleep a little amount. I did that and I was always tired. I struggled and strived and I wasted so much time. Now I know just when the body's tired, it's not me, not mine, not a self, it's just tiredness. I don't fight nature anymore. I work with nature, I make peace with it. And that way I don't need to sleep so much. When you're not fighting, you don't get so tired. When you're at peace, you've got more energy. And it's natural energy, not coming from pride and ego and the self. I've got to get up early in the morning. I've got to get up. I've got to be the first one in the hall. And those of you who get here first, you look around. Ha ha, I'm the first one here. And then late at night, you've got to stay, be the last out the hall. When you're looking around, why does he go? Why does he go? Because then I can be the last. So don't look at other people. Don't worry. If you need to sleep, sleep. And that way it becomes this beautiful natural process of meditation. You get peaceful, you're tranquil, you're at ease, middle way. Most people, including everybody here, are very highly motivated. That's why I don't need to motivate you anymore. You're too motivated. That's why you've got to say, sleep, take it easy, rest. To get that middle part. After meditation, the mind is still reactive. I can't fall asleep. How to calm down the mind so I can go to sleep? Look, if the mind doesn't want to go to sleep, leave it alone. If it doesn't want to go to sleep, then don't make it go to sleep. So work with the mind. So, if you know you're meditating there, you're mindful, and it's time, you know, you think it's time you go to sleep, it's 10 o'clock, and you're still awake, then meditate some more. Just meditate and make the mind nice and peaceful, even if you meditate all night. And then when it comes to 7 o'clock, don't need a breakfast, you can go to your room and have a nice nap. And it's great at 7 o'clock because no one's in the room, no one will be snoring, you have the whole room to yourself. Oh, isn't that nice? So don't worry about, oh, I've got to get so many hours for sleep. The body doesn't work that way. Some days you don't need hardly any sleep at all. Some days you need a lot. It's just, you know, the rhythms of your body. You know, so the women have their rhythms. They sometimes have energy, sometimes they don't. You've got to work with that. The men have their rhythms as well. You've got to work with the rhythms of the body. Sometimes you really need to sleep a lot. Sometimes hardly at all. So work with that. And don't think, oh, I have to sleep at this time. I have to sleep so much. Be natural. Bhante, whenever we are challenged by difficult decisions, we are told to follow the heart. This heart needs to know which virtue or virtues to fall back on. Of all the virtues, namely honesty, sincerity, loving-kindness, compassion, etc., which is paramount? How do we skillfully and clearly decide the base of these virtues? Again, that's more thinking. You don't think about these things, you feel it. What you can do is just you put all the information into your brain. So if you've got a decision to make, sort of find out, you know, what that decision is, what the consequences will be, how it will affect you, how it will affect others. Put as much information in your brain as you possibly can key in. Then once you've got enough information, just press the button and allow it to sort of gestate inside the mind. Just leave it alone for a while and then go and do something else. You heard in my little booklet, I say when you have a decision to make, using the old metaphor, you come to a crossroads in life. Which way should you go? What should you do? If you cannot decide straight away, if it's not absolutely obvious, my advice, using that metaphor, is to sit down at the crossroads and wait for the bus. Because when a bus comes, it's got the destination written on front. Whether it's going to Johor or Penang or Ipoh or wherever, You can see if you go to any bus station, on the front of the bus is the destination. So when you're sitting in the crossroads of life, and you have an important decision to make, you wait. And then a bus will come along, an idea, and you'll have the destination on the front. If that's where you want to go, get on the bus. If you don't want to go to that destination, sit down, there's always another bus coming behind. So in other words, you don't have to rush with the decisions. If it doesn't feel good, if that's not where you want to go, stop. Another decision, another opportunity will happen soon. Which is how you make decisions in life. So often, when I'm sitting down waiting for the bus, when I've got a decision to make, and I don't know which way to go, you know, things happen, things change, I don't need to make that decision anyway. And sometimes you worry, why did I worry so much about this decision? Should I do this? Should I do that? And in the end, you don't do anything. Like recently, I was supposed to go to this Buddhist summit in Burma. I had all these decisions to make, and in the end I found it was cancelled. So I didn't have to make any decisions anyway, like sitting at the crossroads, and the bus didn't even come. So I didn't need to go anywhere. Isn't that wonderful? So many decisions in life you think are important, after a while, they're not important at all. Ajahn, when my leg was paining this morning meditation, I went into the pain and generated the sense of gratitude, appreciate, gratefulness towards my leg, and embracing all the pain there was there. To my surprise, everything went, only peace left. I realized all the wholesome states are acts of letting go. At that moment I let go of greed, hate, and delusion. Is it correct to say that wholesome mental states equals letting go? Yes, exactly. So, thank you for letting go of that piece of paper for me. That was very wholesome. Sometimes when I see someone is suffering, I can't control my tears with compassion. With compassion does one feel sad too. Okay, when I see someone else suffering. Sometimes you have compassion, but remember that compassion always has to go two ways. Actually, many ways usually. The person who you're looking at is only one being in this world. There are other beings as well, and you count too. For example, in my monastery there are 20 monks. Sometimes there's one monk who's misbehaving, and they say, Ajahn Brahm, you should ask him to leave. And I said, no, I've got compassion towards him. The poor fellow's having a very difficult time. If you knew all the reasons why he was, you know, saying these things or doing these things, you would understand. And then they look at me and say, but Ajahn Brahm, there are another 19 monks in this monastery. Please have compassion for them as well. And they told me, your compassion has to be even. Sometimes it's just too easy just to look at that one suffering person and forget all the other people in your family, in your business, or in your life. Even to forget about yourself. You count too. So compassion has to be wise. If you see somebody suffering, you have to see all the other people as well. Including yourself, because what you do affects them as well. So sometimes you do have to ask a monk to leave, out of compassion for all the other monks there. Sometimes they have to, when somebody wants to ask a question or they come and talk to me after the talk, I have to say, please go now, because I have to have compassion for myself as well. If I work myself too hard, I'm going to die and I won't be able to answer any questions. So the compassion has to be wise compassion. So if you see somebody suffering, if your tears can help the situation, then cry. But remember, there's other people as well who need your kindness, need your energy. And if when you see someone suffering, you can't do anything about it, just give your kindness and move on. So often that's the case in life. There's some people in so much pain and so much suffering. A lot of it they made themselves and they don't want to come out. You can't help them. Sometimes it's very sad as a monk, first of all, when you saw that. You realized you couldn't help them. They were going to die, they were going to commit suicide, they were going to do terrible things. There's no way you could help them. You knew that. So you just had to stand back. There's some people you just can't help. You have to let go. It's sad. But you know, maybe in the future, you may have put a little seed in there which is not going to germinate now, but maybe in the future it will. You have to let go. Number two, can one attain Sotapanna stage without doing meditation? We've already asked that question. Has anyone got any comments about the compassion business? Okay, next one.
Ajahn, pure land, recitation of Amitabha Buddha's name and meditation share the same goal, to achieve one pointedness of the mind, one on the Buddha's name, one on the breath. But the approach seems different, as recitation has a dua mind, being aware, whereas meditation attempts to still the dua mind. In my analysis, correct, or both approaches are basically the same. If both differ in approach, isn't it easier to keep the dua mind occupied with the recitation, since us beginners have very active dua minds? Okay, really, they all go in the same direction. You just let go of the dua little by little by little. Instead of even chanting the Amitabha name, you can always do the Buddho name. Buddho, Buddho, Buddho. It's called a mantra recitation. In Australia, because people haven't got a foundation in Buddhism, and you know, say the Buddha, Amitabha, it doesn't really mean much to them. So I gave them an Australian mantra they can do along with their breath. I told them, as you're breathing in, you don't say Buddha, you don't say the name of Amitabha. As you breathe in, you recite the word shut. As you breathe out, up. Shut, up. Shut, up. Along with your breath. And it's very effective for Western minds. Shut up, shut up, shut up. Because you keep saying that to yourself after a while, you do shut up. In other words, you're quiet and peaceful. So the point is, sometimes to stop the doing, we have to have like a halfway house, like a half doing. So we can't give up all doing. We're active. We can't just go from fourth gear to full stop. We have to go from fourth gear to third gear to second gear to first gear, and then we apply the brake. So it's just like we slow down gently. So you can start chanting because that slows you down gently. But that's only going from fourth gear to third gear. Soon you have to let go of the chanting and just like feel the process with no words. That's going from third gear to second gear. Then you go to nimittas, which is going to the first gear. You're hardly doing anything at all. Then you can put on the brake and go into jhanas and stop. So this is how we slow down gradually. So all the meditations, it's all going the same direction. Whether you start with meditating on Buddha or Shatap or the name of Amitabha, or even if you can do a Jesus prayer or whatever, it doesn't really matter. After a while, you let go of the words. Mind becomes still, and you go even deeper. Some teachers advocate that we select one method of cultivation, stick to it to gain results. I have practiced Buddha name recitation and also other meditations. Should I choose only one method of practice and give up the other? Do you always eat the same food every day? Do you always drink the same drinks every day? Variety is the spice of life. So spice up your meditation with like a few different techniques. And you'll find that each different technique has got different proteins and minerals in it to supplement your good health. And recitation has a particular type of flavor and it's got goodness for your heart. Breath meditation has another type of vitamins and minerals. And the other types, metta meditation, has got this beautiful vitamin L, vitamin love supplement, which will create so much peace and happiness and energy inside your heart. So each type of meditation has got a different type of vitamin and mineral and protein. If you take a balanced diet, a varied diet, that's probably the best. It's the same with meditation. If you are digging a well, you can't just use a spade all the time. Sometimes you come across rocks. You need a pick, maybe even a hammer and chisel, or maybe even dynamite to overcome those really hard obstructions to your meditation. You can't always stick to the same tool. You are digging the same well. It's the same mind you're working on. You're going in the same direction. You just use different tools for different problems. That's why you should develop a variety of meditations, a variety of tools to be used for different problems as they come up. 3, I've read that though there are many Buddhas, they are one. Does this mean that the Buddhas appear differently in name and form, but in reality are that they are the same? A Dhamma body is the same. Each different Buddha was a different stream of consciousness, a different name and form. They're not the same in that respect, but the Dharma they taught was the same. But not just the Buddhas, every Arahat, the Dharma they teach is the same. The Dharma which you realize will be the same.
How can emptiness be different? Things can be different. Emptiness is always the same. So that way you understand. In one way you can look upon it and say they're all different. Another way you can see them as all the same. The same in their essence, different in their form. So the Buddha lives when the Dhamma lives. Please explain Buddha nature. Is it the nimitta which we have mentioned that exists in all beings? No, the Buddha nature is your ability to be the most pure, wonderful, enlightened being. You have the seed of enlightenment. And I've been watering it all week. If you think your seed has all died and has been dried out and is not growing at all, your seed has germinated already. It's growing below the surface, like a little green shoot. Who knows, it may be today you find the first little green shoot above the ground. Ah, it's working. You get your first nimitta, your first bliss, your first real deep insight. It's growing. So that I've been nurturing that all week. So that is your Buddha nature, growing closer and closer to enlightenment. And you know it's growing closer because you become more like the Buddha. You become more compassionate, more kind, more smiley. You don't get angry at people, you don't get upset. You're more compassionate, more equanimous, more peaceful. The closer you get to the Buddha, the closer your Buddha nature merges with the enlightened emptiness. Ajahn, kindly explain the meaning of the three gems. Every morning, afternoon, after food we pray, but I do not know the meaning of the triple gem. Okay, that's the most wonderful jewel. It's most precious jewel. That's why sometimes people say, in the eight precepts, why can't we wear jewelry? And I say, okay, you ladies, you can wear three gems. Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. That's the only jewelry you can have. And those are precious gems which no burglar can carry off from out of your house. You don't need to have an insurance policy on the triple gem. So isn't it wonderful you have the most valuable things and no one can take them away? Actually, only Mara, only ignorance and stupidity can steal your triple gem. So this is the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. They call the triple gem because they're the most valuable things in the whole world. Doesn't matter how wealthy you are, if you get depressed, sick, angry, all your money doesn't help at all. All the US's money can't solve its problems, let alone the most wealthy people in the world. But the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha can solve the problems. The wisdom and compassion of the Buddha, the great teachings of the Dhamma, and the example of the Sangha, to inspire you that, yeah, though the Buddha had died many years ago, passed away into Nibbana, you still have the memory in the teachings of Dhamma. That is really inspiring. When you understand what the Buddha truly is, it's incredible inspiration. When you actually touch the Dhamma, it's no longer just words. When the Dhamma is not coming from the books or from the monk or the nun, but coming from deep within your heart. When you have the gem inside of you, that's so powerful. When you have the inspiration, the knowledge that so many people have walked this path and become members of the Aryan Sangha, stream winners, once returners, non-returners, arahats. Just as in the time of the Buddha, it's happening now. People just like you, so many of you think, oh, I'm such a long way. I can never be a noble one, stream winning, once returning, arahat. Maybe for other people, not for me. And the day comes when you see the Dhamma and you realize that, yeah, you too can be one of those Aryans. Just in the time of the Buddha, it's happening now. That gives you so much inspiration. That the path is still valid. People are still walking on that path. People are still getting all of those realizations. That's why I like people to get into jhanas. One of the descriptions of the jhanas is walking in the footprints of the Buddha. You know the first teaching which the Buddha gave when he went, not the Buddha, which the Arahat Mahinda gave when he went to Sri Lanka. When they took Buddhism to Sri Lanka, the very first sermon of the Arahat Mahinda was the greater discourse on the elephant's footprint, the Mahahatipadopama Sutra. In that, he gave the simile of someone searching for the footprints of a great elephant. And he mentioned that it's like the footprints of a Buddha. Have you ever seen the footprint of the Buddha? Have you ever gone on pilgrimage to see the places where there's supposed to be the footprint of the Buddha? You are going on that pilgrimage now. Because the footprint of the Buddha does not lie on Adam's Peak in Sri Lanka. Nor does the footprint of the Buddha lie in Phuttabat in Thailand or in the north of Thailand. There's several places which are supposed to have footprints of the Buddha. In this sutta, the Buddha himself described the four footprints of the Buddha. You know what those footprints are? The first footprint of the Buddha is found within you. It's called first jhana. Second footprint is second jhana. Third is third jhana. The fourth is fourth jhana. When you get into those states, you are, according to the description of the Buddha, standing in the footprint of a Buddha. You're experiencing the mind of a Buddha. You're standing where the Buddha once stood. In those jhanas, there's no difference between you and a Buddha mind. That's why it's powerful. Blows your mind. Gives you incredible bliss. More inspiration you've ever had before. So, that's where you experience the three gems. It's not just standing back looking over there. It's standing inside. That's why they're powerful states. So those of you who want to go to pilgrimage to the four holy sites, what are the four holy sites again? First jhana, second jhana. You go to pilgrimage to the holy sites inside your mind. They're the best. When a yogi passes away, can he or she take the opportunity of his or her last moment to attain jhana after all the five senses have been shut down except the mind and nibbida? Yeah, it's a great time to get a jhana. When you just passing away, because you're letting go, you're not doing anything. You can't do anything when you're dying. People struggle, they try to do things, it makes it much worse. So just let go. Many of you have written and have told me you can experience pain and let go of it. Great, when you die you have more pain, you can let go of that. Let go of your body, let go of your wealth, let go of your family, let go of your concerns, let go of everything. Let go of your body, let go of your senses. Great thing to do. Ajahn, I tried to follow the metta meditation this morning, but I could not feel it in my heart. Normally I will feel sad or compassion when I see the little kitten in the natural scene, but I don't have that feeling this morning. No feeling at all. What should I do? Well, you just do the breath meditation. If it doesn't work, don't force yourself. Have loving kindness to yourself. The door of my heart is open to me. If I can't do it, that's fine. Dear me, there you are. So look at your own eyes. Think this poor yogi who can't even do metta meditation of a morning. That's okay. The door of my heart is open to me. There you are, so lonely, so afraid, so sort of cold because you can't get the warmth of metta meditation. So take your own being inside your arms and think, oh, never mind. I can still be my friend. Even if I'm the most useless meditator in the whole of this retreat, I can still be my friend. Just like the lonely, hungry cat, just all skin and bones. You've got no fat of wisdom on you at all. You are just so cold, you've got no loving kindness at all. You're just so weak because you've got no wisdom at all. You're just like this poor little kitten who had no nurturing at all. Ah. Take yourself in your arm, the most stupid meditator there's ever been since the birth of the Buddha. The most hopeless person. If that's how you think of yourself, you really need your compassion. Ah. So be compassionate towards yourself if you can't do anything. Next question. I try to follow the metta meditation. Oh, this one. Next question. Here we go. Dear Ajahn, during retreat we take vegetarian meals. Would you encourage Buddhists to convert to full-time vegetarian to reduce craving and develop compassion and loving kindness towards animals? If you can do it, great, but don't be a fundamentalist vegetarian. Don't be an evangelical meat hater. Because I did this, I was a vegetarian before I became a monk. As a monk, you had to eat everything you'd given. And I said in the early years, we had to eat frog on rice because that's all there was. I'd have given anything to have some tofu in those days. But when I was a lay person and I was a vegetarian, on one occasion I was invited to dinner by my girlfriend. Unfortunately, I don't know how she could do this. She forgot I was a vegetarian. She made this beautiful, she made brown rice for me, health food, but she made this curry with meat. And I refused to eat it. And I really upset her. And even now when I think about it, you stupid person, why did I do that? I should have just eaten that meat. She went through so much care and time cooking that meal for me, cooking that dinner for me. And I just turned my nose at it, up at it. I loved animals, but I hated people, basically. So if that was the case, now, if that would happen again, then somebody, I said I was a vegetarian, they made meat for me, I would eat that meat out of compassion for them. So don't be an evangelical sort of vegetarian. And there are many around. They apparently happened in I think, the United States. These vegetarians, they blew up the butcher shops. Crazy, you mean kidding people. You love animals, but you hate the butchers. Crazy. So it's like compassion and kindness. The reason why you're vegetarian is like for compassion for animals, and that should go to people as well. It should go to carnivores, the people who eat meat. So your compassion goes to all beings. So don't look down upon meat eaters if you're a vegetarian. Be kind to all beings. It's your personal choice if you can do it. Your health allows you. Sometimes people can't do it because of health reasons. Or because, you know, you have a husband who's a meat eater. Or because your parents don't approve. Whatever it is, if you can do it, it's a wonderful thing to do. But don't make it an evangelical cause célèbre. Dear Ajahn Brahm, the breathing seems to interfere with the walking. My mind tends to focus on the breath more and sometimes make it difficult to balance. How to take off the breath? Okay. Tell yourself then, use reverse psychology, tell your mind, okay, you must watch the breath, you must watch the breath, you must watch the breath. And then your mind will go on strike and just watch the feet then. Because it's obviously your mind does everything other than follow your instructions. You're like this little teenager. I know you may have heard these stories from the Islamic tradition of the Mullah Nasruddin. He was supposed to be this Sufi in Persia many, many centuries ago. A whole book of the stories. And they're very, very interesting, great fun to read. They have a lot of wisdom behind them as well. In one occasion, Nasruddin was growing up. He was a teenager and he would help his father transport salt. That was their business, the salt business. They would use donkeys to carry the salt from one place to another. But on the journey, they had to cross the narrow bridge, which was just one plank wide. And when you're carrying a donkey over this bridge, over this river, sometimes the donkey would be leaning over to the left. So Nasruddin's father would say, he'd see the donkey on to the left, he said, push the donkey over to the left. Because he knew his son, when he'd heard that, would always do the opposite and push the donkey over to the right. So if the donkey was leaning over to the right, the father would say, push it further over to the right. Because the teenager would always do the opposite and put it over to the left. You know, the classical reverse psychology, hundreds of years ago. But then one day, the donkey was leaning over to the left, and the father said, push it further over to the left, and he did it, and it fell in. He said, what do you do that for? He said, oh, don't you remember, it was my birthday today, I'm 20, I'm no longer a teenager. This is what teenagers have to do. They have to be sort of, that's part of the tradition. Very funny stories. So, use reverse psychology. If you can't do it, tell yourself to do something else and you will do it. It's like, sometimes if you can't watch the breath when you're meditating. This story was told to me by one of my meditators. He had such a hard time watching his breath. He was a Westerner. But he went to this teacher, who was absolutely brilliant, and the teacher said, look, you've been trying to watch your breath all these years. Stop it. Don't even try anymore. What you can do, sit down, close your eyes, get yourself nice and peaceful, then imagine you're watching the breath. He did it with them. Sit down, close your eyes, and get yourself comfortable. Now imagine you're watching the breath. Don't do it, just imagine. Imagine you're breathing in, imagine you're breathing out. Imagine you're breathing in, imagine you're breathing out. And so he spent about 2 or 3 minutes imagining he was watching the breath. And then she said, what are you doing? He said, actually, I'm watching the breath. Because there's no difference between imagining it and actually doing it. So you can use imagination sometimes, and it works. If you don't have a limiter, try it. Imagine you've got this amazing, beautiful light in front of you. The most bright and glorious light you've ever had. Just so bright and brilliant. If you've got a decent imagination, you will actually create that limiter. And then you'll have it right there in front of you. Imagination is just working with the mind. That's all it is. So if you can't, if you're breathing, or sorry, if you're walking and you can't actually feel the feet, walk, imagine you're feeling the feet. And then you'll be feeling the feet. Oh, do I focus on my feet or focus somewhere far ahead? So I focus far ahead, I tend to lose balance. Usually it's a couple of meters in front of you. You watch. Maybe it can be a meter, maybe 3 meters, whatever's comfortable for you. The purpose of that is so you can see if there's any obstacles in front of you, if there's any snakes, or if there's any cockroaches, or anything else which you want to avoid. You can see it so you're not so afraid. So try looking 1 or 2 meters in front of you. That's all you need to do with walking meditation. Next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is Ajahn's patented metta meditation available in print? If so, can we get a copy? It is available in print. It's imprinted upon your hearts and minds. You've already had 3 copies so far. And that's the essence of my metta meditation. Because you have the essence inside of you and you can just adapt it to your own particular style. So you don't need actually to put these things in print. You don't need to photograph them, because if you take a photograph, it's not the same as a real thing. You can take a photograph of me. You can see that picture behind me. That's not me. So why do we want to keep all these things in print? These things flow. They're like a tree, like a flower. It's always growing. So your metta meditation grows. You've got the seed, and that's good enough. 2, I am interested to read articles, books by Ajahn, in particular the journal. No, we have copy of the booklet Jhana, chapter 13 of the journal. What about other chapters of the journal? We would like to have a copy. Are they still available in print? If so, can Chimpaka Buddhist Lodge assist in this matter? These are Ajahn Brahm's secret teachings. These are only for the deep meditators. Those with enormous good karma. If you've got the good karma, those books will come to you. If you haven't, all the asking will not get those books at all. So now what's happening? Those chapters are going to be published by Wisdom Publications in the US coming out at the end of this year, in a book titled The Beautiful Breath. The reason I'm publishing these booklets, like opening the door of the heart, instead of giving them out for free, it's one reason is that when they're published for free, you never get them into bookshops. So they just get to Buddhists and just your inner circle. They never get further than that. So I wanted to try something different, to get those teachings to a wider circulation, to go to a professional publisher so they can go all over the world. Okay, it does cost a bit of money, but it doesn't matter. It's all dana. And so that means it will actually get wider. And the other reason is that many people, maybe not in Malaysia, not yogis and Buddhists, because you know what free distribution booklets are, but there are many people, if you put free distribution booklets at the entrance there, they will take them anyway. And they'll take them home, look at them, this is boring, and throw it away. But if they pay 60 ringgit for it, they wouldn't throw it away so easily. It's really sad sometimes that they can give a talk here, and because it's free, so that people, maybe they come, maybe they don't come. But if you advertise in Chimpaka Buddhist Lodge, there's an Australian motivational psychologist with degrees from Cambridge University who's coming to give a talk on how to get rid of depression, how to create happiness, how to become enlightened. $3,000 a night. This place will be packed. It's incredible how stupid people are. They think if it costs a lot of money, it must be something special. If it's free, it can't be worth anything. That's what people think. It can't be worth anything. That's what people think these days. So recently I was giving a series of talks in Sydney. And the person who was actually running the talks, I was giving these talks, and her son went off to the Gold Coast. It was one of these motivational psychologists from the US. They were charging, I think, $7,000 for the weekend. You stupid child, you could have come to your mother's center and have seen better things for free. But no, because it was $7,000, they thought it must be special. $7,000 US just for one weekend. Crazy. So anyway, I forgot what the question was, but it's something to do with that, anyway. Oh yeah, my books, yeah. They may be available soon. They'll come to you. Dear Rajan, you told us it is good to watch the breath outside the body. Could you please kindly share with us how you watch your breathing during meditation? What do you use to resemble your breath outside your body? I didn't say outside, but disconnected to any body. So you're not watching the breath at the nose. You're not watching the breath at the stomach. You're not watching the breath anywhere in the body. You're just watching the breath. So it's a feeling of the breath. It's like when you're angry. When you're angry, where is it located in your body? It doesn't really matter. Don't look for it. When you're angry, you know you're angry. When you're happy, you know you're happy. When you're breathing, you know you're breathing. Who cares where in the body it's located? So I just watch the breathing without pinpointing it on any part of the body. And that was very helpful for me, because if the meditation is supposed to encourage the body to disappear, my body disappeared very quickly. Because I didn't have any link with my consciousness to the legs, the stomach, the nose or the head or anywhere. So body disappeared very, very quickly. So you're just watching breath, breathing in, breathing out. You couldn't feel any part of the body. That's how I used to meditate, and it was very helpful. So I could always watch the breath, because the breath was always happening. It was happening somewhere. So that's where I watched. Just the same, the old simile, if you've got a detective, a secret agent, and they're following a suspect terrorist, if the terrorist goes into the temple, the detective has to follow it into the temple. If the suspect goes into the bank, then the detective also has to go into the bank. If the suspected terrorist goes into the ladies' toilet, then the detective has to go into the same toilet. It doesn't matter where it's supposed to be. The detective has to go where the suspect goes. So in that simile, the suspect is your breath. You are the detective. Mindfulness is the detective. The mindfulness has to follow the breath. Wherever the breath goes, that's where you go. It's not to say, oh, the breath should be at the tip of the nose. It's not to say the breath, oh, it should be at the abdomen. Because sometimes it's not. Sometimes your breath might be at your ear hole. Who cares? It's not supposed to be there. That's weird, but if that's where it's going to be, that's where I'm going to watch. That's only an example. I never breathe through my ear hole, but just in case it happens. You know what I'm talking about. So wherever it is, that's where you watch it. And after a while, you don't care that perception of the location in the body is taken away, and with it, the perception of the body disappears, and you're free. Ajahn Brahm, how to behave as a leader? What attitude should one display as a leader? Being too kind, the subordinates tend to take advantage of their leaders and will not do their jobs properly. Sadhu. How to be a leader? You have to lead by example. As a leader, especially a Buddhist leader, you should be strict on yourself and kind to others. Most people are kind to themselves and strict on others. No, be strict to yourself and kind on others. Be compassionate, and then you lead by encouragement. When other people know that you're working for them, they will work for you. That's how I lead. I really give to others, and other people say, my goodness, Ajahn Brahm's giving so much, we want to help him. So I encourage people, lead by example. If I want other people to give, I should give. If I want other people to be kind, I must be kind. If I want other people to meditate, I must meditate. If I want other people to be peaceful, I must be peaceful. If I'm angry at you, and I tell you to be peaceful, what sort of example is that? So you find that you get much more out of your disciples, out of the people who work for you, with encouragement, than you do with force. If you are a forceful leader, they may do what you say just out of fear. But when you leave and you go away, then, okay, the boss isn't there, we can do whatever we want now because we won't get caught. If I hadn't been leading by example, by compassion, in my monastery in Perth, I'd be so afraid to leave it. Because I've encouraged those monks in Perth. I know they're, from inside, they're very kind, they're peaceful, they're good, and they're wise. That's why as a leader I can take weeks off. A good leader, a good CEO, can always take Friday afternoon off to play golf. What I mean by that is if you're a good leader, you don't always have to be the control freak. You can delegate. And you can trust those people to do the right thing. If you're a bad leader, always dominant, creating fear, you can never take time off. Because you're afraid if I'm not there, things will go wrong. You're a control freak. A good leader delegates. Okay, next question. My goodness, there's no end to questions. When will they end? Ajahn, can someone who is gay or lesbian progress in meditation until enlightenment? Yes, you can. A gay or lesbian can do as much as a heterosexual. It's not whether you're a heterosexual or a homosexual, it's how you're a heterosexual or how you're homosexual. Because there's many gay disciples of mine in Perth, they got committed relationships, good meditators, they keep precepts, they give generously, they're great people. And there's some heterosexuals, they sleep with other people's wives, they drink, they're mean, they're cruel, they hardly ever give a donation, they ask for all the help. So it doesn't really matter whether you're heterosexual or homosexual, it's how you practice that way, with compassion and wisdom or not. Two, did they do something wrong in their past lives to be born like this? We've all done something wrong in our past lives, otherwise we wouldn't be born. So it's not just them, it's you as well. So I remember getting this letter some years ago from someone in, I think it was in Johor. They said they just found out their son was gay. Ah, what should I do? I said, now listen, how many times have you heard the chant of loving kindness? May all beings be happy and well. The door of my heart's open to everybody, no matter who they are. Isn't a gay person a living being, a sentient being? Can't you open the door of your heart to them as well? That's your son, for goodness sake. Love your son for who they are. And never be embarrassed about who your son is. Be proud of your son. Okay, time is coming up. Okay, dear Ajahn, this is not gays, this is about lay people. Dear Ajahn, can a lay person be enlightened? Yes, they can. It's up to you. The doors of enlightenment are open. Do you want to come in? It's that easy. The doors of your prison are always wide open, but sometimes we don't want to go out. Some people, it's like that. They've been in prison for many years, and then they get their sentence is ended, and they say, you can be free now. They don't want to go out. They're so used to prison, they're afraid of freedom. Just like you. You've been in the prison of the defilements for so long. Greed, hate, and delusion, you're comfortable with them. Sort of, okay, they're a bit painful sometimes, but you know, you're used to them. The idea of freedom, ooh, that's scary. Which is why when you get into deep meditation, ooh, that's scary. What are you afraid of? You're afraid of freedom. So, you can be. if you want to. 2, what is the place of Dutanga austerity practice in the Buddha's path? Is it prerequisite for enlightenment? Does it enhance psychic powers? You can do like these ascetic practices for a month. They're not that ascetic. They say like 1 meal a day in one bowl. You still eat. It's not eating. The Buddha said if you're not eating, that's going too far. Sometimes it may be not laying down at night, but you don't do it all the time. Sometimes you do these things, sometimes you don't. It's little things, like as a monk, whatever hut he's given, he just stays in that hut. In other words, it's just not to have too many desires, that's all it is. But some people, when some monks, these heavily, highly motivated, mostly Western monks, especially American monks, they read the 13 Dutangas, they think, right, I'm going to do the whole lot. Until you explain that 2 of them is, one is staying in the forest, the other one is staying in the open air. You can't do both at the same time. They say, it doesn't matter, I'll do it. Because it's like spiritual materialism, it's pride and ego. I'm going to be the toughest monk ever. I am going to be the toughest yogi that Chempaka Lodge has ever seen. Other people might sleep, but not me. Look at all those fat meditation cushions everyone's got. Look at mine, it's thin. In fact, I'm not going to use a meditation cushion. I'm going to use broken glass. See how tough I am. Now, some people think that's a way to enlightenment. This ain't the way to enlightenment. That's stupidity. So, if you have like really gross defilements, if you're really gross, then sometimes the teachers have to use gross methods. If you're refined, refined methods. So it's only the real gross monks need those Dutangas. And if you have to do those Dutangas, then obviously you've done... This is a bit cruel of the Buddha, but someone asked him about these Jain ascetics. Because these Jain ascetics, they were standing on one leg all day, facing the sun, going naked, eating so little. He said, what do you think about those? And the Buddha said, you've got to respect them because they've got so much endurance. They go through so much pain. But listen, if they're enduring that much pain, they must have done some terribly bad karma in their past life. So in the same way, if you have to do those Dutangas, you must have done some very, very bad karma to have to endure those bad karma, those Dutangas. Is Vimokka Samapatti the same as Nirodha Samapatti? It's not really, because the Vimokkas are the jhanas. So if you get first jhana, that's one of the Vimokkas. They're called Atta Vimokkas, the 8 liberations. So any of the jhanas is Vimokkas, but Nirodha Samapatti is just one of the Vimokkas, one of the freedoms, the highest of them. So Vimokka Samapatti is not the same as Nirodha Samapatti. Nirodha Samapatti is one of the 8 Vimokkas. Vimokka means freedom, like moksha in Sanskrit. Vimokka is freedom. It's a great word, freedom. It's the liberation of the mind. It's a liberation from greed, hate and delusion. You're out of the prison, you're free at last. Why do we want to be free? Because we're attached to attachment. We've been attached all our life. We don't want to let go. We don't want to let go of our money. We don't want to let go of our parents and our children. We don't even want to let go of our pain. Strange thing. Oh my goodness, look at all these ones left. Ah. It's okay, I'm going to let go of the whole lot. So we don't want to let go. There was this story, one more story. The story of this guy who was getting very, very sick in hospital. This is many, many, many years ago in New York. He was getting so sick and in constant pain, whatever the doctors did, whatever they injected, they couldn't get rid of his pain. And his daughter was, she was a disciple of one of these Hindu gurus. And of course, her father just didn't want anything to do with these crazy people from India. But nevertheless, she came to visit him. She brought her guru with her. Maybe to teach something to her father. As soon as the father saw this strange-looking Indian with the long hair and the wild eyes and the rags for clothes, said, get him out of here. But he wouldn't go leave the room. He just stood at the end of the bed while his daughter talked, while the daughter talked to her father. And the guru, while the daughter was speaking to the father, thought, well, I've got nothing else to do. I might as well give him a foot massage. So he started massaging, without permission, this very, very sick person's feet. And while the sick person was talking to his daughter, he suddenly stopped. For the first time in weeks, the pain had disappeared. He was absolutely free of pain. He couldn't believe it. So he looked at this Indian guru and said, get away from my feet! He would rather have his pain than have his theories and philosophies compromised. He was attached to his theories, so he'd rather have his pain than have something he couldn't understand and be free. That's what attachment is sometimes. Sometimes we'd rather have our pain and our problems than be free. Because freedom is just, sometimes we don't know what to make of it. Good story. So please, if all your pains and suffering disappears, don't think, what's happening? Allow it to be. When the prison door opens, walk out. Okay, so that's enough for today. And probably for tomorrow as well, by the look of it. Okay, so thank you for the question. Maybe, because we've got so many questions, I'm going to ban questions today. So you can't write any questions for the next 24 hours because I've got enough for tomorrow. So no questions for the next 24 hours so I can have a chance of answering the ones here. And now we have meditation, we have interviews. The doors of the deathless are open. So walk through. And then when you walk through, if you become enlightened, you will not need any more questions answered. You will not need any more interviews. And you can give Ajahn Brahm an easy life. So please, there's so many interviews with so many questions. Please become enlightened out of compassion for me. Okay, carry on.